From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. More U.S. sanctions for Russia, the latest being imposed over the Skripal case in the U.K. For more on that, we spoke with Professor Tony Montero, live from Philadelphia via Skype on Thursday. Professor Montero, just trying to make sense out of the latest with these sanctions.
You know, which in one sense are puzzling, given Trump's meeting in Helsinki with Putin, and the article in Politico, which I think is kind of reliable, where the Russian government or the people around Putin kind of said what they talked about, and what they talked about were significant issues such as arms agreement about nuclear weapons, agreements about no nuclear weapons in space, and about Syria, and, you know, recognition that there's not been an arms control agreement between the two largest nuclear weapons nations in the world. There's not been an agreement since 1993.
Yeah, plus there's been abrogation of a few of the most basic ones, too, in the intervening period.
Or allowing them to fizzle out because their time frame had ended.
Right, they lapsed.
They lapsed, yes. And so now these sanctions over allegations about using chemical weapons to poison this former agent or
Skripal,
The Skripals in England. And how does that rise to the level of a need for sanctions against Russia at a time when the two leaders are warming up to each other and talking about doing something substantive about nuclear weapons and other hot spots and tensions in the world? It seems to me that that Trump is isolated within his own administration, and this sounds more like Bolton and Pompeo and people around them than it does like Trump. And it came out of nowhere.
Yeah.
And they're even talking about tightening up on these sanctions, and eventually some of them are saying forbidding Aeroflot, the Russian airline, to land in the United States.
Yeah.
So we got, I mean, two diametrically opposite trends going on within the Trump administration.
Yep.
Now, I don't know how Trump is himself thinking about this. Maybe it's about the 2018 election, and the Republicans need to appear to be tough on Russia. There's been some language like that used by Trump in the recent weeks,
yep,
about the Russians didn't really want him and all of this type of thing.
I've been tougher on Russia than Obama was, or Clinton, etc.
Yeah. And that's more, I think, stump rhetoric.
Yeah.
I don't know. But ultimately, it's quite dangerous. And then you have, you know, the ratcheting up of sanctions against Turkey. And we should be reminded that never before had sanctions by any NATO nation been imposed upon another NATO nation.
That's right.
In other words, you know, this is a serious issue and a serious blow, I would put it this way, to NATO, and especially to its eastern flank, which can only drive Turkey out of NATO and closer to Russia, China, and Iran.
You've already had also, I mean, Turkey has been getting trying to join the EU for a really long time. And only in the last few years, it has finally got it into its head that basically, guess what? They're not going to let us join their European club, period. And starting to chart out a little bit of an independent course. But I think also, if you look at the backdrop to this stuff, I just wanted, before we got further into Turkey with Russia, with all of this stuff going on with Russia, we had the day before yesterday a quote-unquote accidental firing of a missile from a NATO fighter jet at the Russian border in Estonia. In other words, shooting a live fire missile from a plane at Russia over Estonia. It was apparently an accident and treated that way. But, all this rhetoric takes place in a certain context where there's an awful lot of gasoline on the ground and a lot of people lighting matches.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's very interesting you bring that up, because according to the Politico article that talks about the Russians' description of the meeting in Helsinki, one of the things that they talked about was drawing back NATO troops on the borders of Russia.
Right.
And there's all of this talk, you might remember, that, well, Trump wanted to make friends with Putin in order to focus upon China.
Right.
And apparently that is the advice that Kissinger gave to Trump.
Right.
That China is the big enemy and split Russia and China.
Right.
I think that it's obvious that for different reasons, Russia and China do constitute, quote, threats to American interest or hegemony. I think that, of course, that the Russia-China alliance is really what concerns politicians and planners and strategic planners in the United States and in other Western countries.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is what they themselves have characterized now for the past few years as a strategic partnership.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And the two leaders, Putin and Xi Jinping, have met, according to one count, 26 times since 2013. And they consider themselves good friends, and they consider their countries to be important allies. And, one of the symbols of this is that the Russian and Chinese navies have carried out joint military exercises in the Sea of Japan and in the Mediterranean, Eastern Mediterranean.
Yep.
And it seems that they agree on a number of things in international relations, including Syria and North Korea, and arms talks and detente between the United States and Russia. But this is the great concern, and what this will mean, and of course, Russia and Turkey are Asian nations, and China is an Asian nation, and the Shanghai Cooperation Organization is a organization of Asian nations, and it's Asia, not just China, that is worrisome. Yeah. For Western strategic planners.
And one of the things people here don't keep in mind when they think about this, the largest nation state in terms of geography in Asia is Russia. So no question. Russia is also an Asian nation, not just a European nation.
It's mainly an Asian nation.
That's correct.
And, you know, it's always been this big question of whether Russia was Western or Asian.
That's right.
And, you know, the czars ruled over an empire that was primarily, essentially, Asian.
That's correct.
And they, the czars, were primarily Western. They spoke right. French yep. in the czarist court.
Right.
With the Russian Revolution, Russia acknowledged its Asianness.
That's right.
And really liberated tens of Asian nations from what was the rule of the czars,
that's
a
right.
colonial rule. And so this Western thing is really not has not played out to the advantage of the Soviet Union or Russia. And I think Putin and Erdogan in Turkey have decided that their natural home in terms of geopolitics is in Asia, and especially in a strong and united Asia with, you know, I would say at least half of the world's population is not only the future in the 21st century, but going forward as far as the eye can see. I would say that Asia as the center of global economic and political power is what we're looking at for the rest of the 21st century. And there's nothing that the United States or the West can do about it. And sanctions against, you know, Turkey or Russia or Iran only serves to bring them closer together and to bring all of them closer to China and eventually to India. I don't know what the likes of Bolton, John Bolton, and Pompeo are thinking about, or any of the rest of them.
Yeah.
Now, on his best days, Trump gets it right.
Yeah.
And on the worst days, Trump accedes to his, quote, advisors and gets it wrong. The issue going forward is, who will win in this internal battle within the Trump administration? Whether Trump has enough strength, enough power in his own administration to win out on his policy of indeed economic competition, sometimes morphing over into trade wars, which are not good, or and detente, of course, which goes along with this, or whether the war hawks who represent the majority of the what we call the deep state, and of course, the majority of the news media, whether that side wins out. Now, here is the great equalizer, I'll put it that way. The vast majority of American people, who, whether they state it like we do or not, applaud at rallies when Trump says to negotiate and to talk to leaders that we don't agree with is a good thing. And so yeah. This 40% of the electorate that stands with Trump, in spite of the attacks upon him for being an agent of Putin and the Russians having manipulated the election, that 40% that stand with him is, I think, the political foundation of what could be a new type of 21st century peace movement, as well as an anti-interventionist movement. And I think we have to come down on their side against the deep state.
You know, if a peace movement or any one, you know, looking to demilitarize the condition of our species. I don't know what language to use for that, but that would be the ultimate goal, to get out from the burden of having these military budgets and all the people dying and all the stuff getting blown up and all of the fuel being burned and all of the horrible things that are consequent to that. There are only a very few paths to that. One is, a global revolution, particularly revolution inside the countries that are the largest military threats, and specifically a revolution in the United States, an anti-militarist, essentially socialist revolution. I checked my calendar. That's not scheduled yet. I'll show up. I'll even help them promote it when it's time, but I don't think it's scheduled yet. Then, because honestly, no one's really hired anybody to do it, and we don't know who the bride and groom are going to be, let alone where to buy the invitations. So then we've got another alternative, which is to force the existing structures to behave in a way that is in accord with what we want. In other words, if we can't put in a new government under a new system that doesn't require war and war making to thrive for itself, then we find a way of having the present system accommodate itself to a condition of no war and demilitarization. And so that means either you elect a new government, which of course is not the way out thus far. You can ask just about anybody who's elected, just about anybody. You're going back to Nixon promising the end of the Vietnam War in a secret plan in 1968. That took 4 years or 6 years after that of intense pressure from us to every one of them. So probably that's not the route either. And certainly no one on the horizon that would replace Trump is saying anything remotely like, let's de-escalate tensions with Russia and China, see if we can't start cutting our militaries in half and then half again, et cetera. Mm-hmm. That's not the language of the Democratic Party or the Republican Party, for that matter. Mm-hmm. So you have then, Trump is all we got. He's in power. How do we pressure him, incentivize him, induce him to move forward? And that means engagement. Mm-hmm. And no one is discussing how to engage the administration to do some of the things that it says it wants to do.
Or I think, I would look at it a bit differently. I think the key question, and this is what we've talked about over these many months, is how do you engage that base, that Trump base?
Right.
That's the first thing.
Yeah, but I'm not referring specifically, literally, to two-dimensional administration. Yeah. I'm talking about there's the president guy there. These are the people that are keeping him in that job.
Absolutely.
Whole contraption. Yeah.
That's right. But, I think what is a growing awareness among the people, and here I'm not talking about politicians or the existing political parties, there is a recognition of the dictatorship of finance capital and the havoc and brutality that it has brought upon the American people and the people of the world. I mean, if we're talking about the decline in the standard of living of the working people and middle classes, and if we are talking about austerity in times where the 0.1% are more wealthy than ever, and the growing inequalities that has wrought, and everybody is talking about that, certainly from the time of Occupy, and of course the Trump candidacy continually brought attention to that, and in his rhetoric and in his campaign, it was a out and out attack upon the financial oligarchs of this country and the institutions that support them, like the media.
Yep.
That is why this great struggle over whether the Republican Party will be the old type Republican Party or whether it will become a Trump Republican Party or Trump Party altogether. Because if it becomes a populist party, you know, a party that is more anchored to the needs and interests of working people and the lower middle classes, the lower professional classes, then it will have to increasingly take on the dictatorship of the financial oligarchy. But at the same time, that means that objectively, this is a democratic movement with a small d, a movement for a people's democracy, for power to the people. I would say in many ways, this is short of an out-and-out socialist revolution, but it is, there is the potential for a political revolution that does not, you know, at one, you know, swoop, do away with all of capitalism, but attacks that tiny minority, which has a dictatorship over the economy, over politics, over the legal system, and on and on and on. I think that's what we're looking at. I don't think we're that far away from that. And if that is the trajectory, then other things are part of it, such as a moving back from military intervention, of moving back from tension, military tensions and other kinds with Russia and China. And, you know, in this respect, this, what I think is not maybe yet a minority, but a significant part of the American people are in alignment with the majority of people around the world. Certainly with the majority of Europeans who are continually voting against the old policies of subservience to U.S. militarism, to the U.S. 1%, the U.S. financial oligarchs, and so on. And clearly, in this majority, this human, this the political majority in the world, I mean, you have to include the Russians, the Chinese, the Indians, most of the Africans, and people in South and Central America. I mean, we're somewhere where we have not been, and it's a good place, and it requires, at the end of the day, a huge amount of political education, which cannot, you know, we cannot just depend upon Trump's rhetoric and that populism. It has to go to another level. And this means, of course, challenging the news, so-called news media, and so that dominate the atmosphere, the ideological atmosphere.
So, yeah, I think one of the problems that I would say maybe the problem that we face is perhaps the same one that we've had to face in this country since its founding, which is the divisions that exist among the members of the working class. You know, white supremacy being the prize that was handed out, you know, to keep this big chunk at odds with, or to allow whatever to happen to everybody else as long as they were still getting paid a little bit at the end of the week. You know, that paycheck stopped, you know, being honored at the bank a long time ago, pretty much. It may get honored if the cops drive down the street and decide, well, we're going to shoot somebody today. Who's it going to be? But in terms of, you know, who's going to get that high-paying job or who's going to get this, that, or the other thing, this system ain't handing out much to anybody anymore except really rich people. You know, the virtual currency is good for a while. Right. But when your stomach starts growling, you know, and you start looking for, you know, you look at your balance sheet, and you see that there's a minus before all those big numbers that were that didn't used to be, that it gets thin pretty quick. And so the material basis for that, those divisions is eroding in some ways, even though the fact of the immiseration of everybody is a kind of a dangerous mix, because a lot of folks will sell out real quick just to get out of the, you know, what looks like a desperate situation coming. And so,
and you know something, Don, I couldn't agree with you more. And the empirical evidence for what you're saying is not so much in the large cities on the East and West Coast, but in places like Chattanooga, Tennessee, or Allentown, Pennsylvania,
yeah,
or Akron, Ohio,
Cleveland,
or Birmingham, yeah, Alabama.
Yep.
And I'm mentioning small or medium-sized cities that were driven by industry. And the industrial oligarchs of the past used the race card to keep the working class divided and thus subservient. But with the decline and deindustrialization of all of these areas, the working class in general has been impoverished and is being more impoverished. This is, I think, the objective conditions for the type of radical people's movements that we are talking about and have talked about, you know, since 2016 are better now than they have perhaps ever been. It's just that there is no left to guide it, to give leadership to it. I think out of this economic and political chaos, indigenous organic leaders will arise. And the type of populism that you and I are interested in will rise out of this political and economic chaos. And that is why, you know, Trump makes a fatal political error in thinking that he can play within the parameters of white supremacy and racist thinking and use the white masses as the vanguard of his political populism. But that's not going to work.
Can't work.
And I think he underestimates his own base. I think among those people who voted and continue to support Trump, there is a huge group that rejects out-and-out racism, you know, that
yep,
sees the, you know, the economics of this thing, of this situation, and are really looking for some form of unity, especially with black working people and the black poor. And this is what we have to, you know, work on continually. And I think Trump fails at that point. He can't have it both ways. You know, you can't be a genuine economic populist and political populist and at the same time try to work within old racist paradigms of thinking.
Well, I mean, and there's the old okey-doke, because here's what happens. He does that, and let's give him the benefit of the doubt for argument's sake. Let's say he's doing it for the constructive intended purpose of trying to do some good for the working class as a whole, which he does say while he's doing this.
Mm-hmm.
And the response, of course, is from the other side, because it's politically exactly where they need to go, and it also accomplishes the same goal that this did in installing white supremacy, what he's practicing. The response also helps to install it, and that is, well, then things are about race. He's making it about race, and they're not about class.
Right.
And so the opposition is organized around the question of race instead of class.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have two camps at each other's throats, and nobody's talking about class. And that is, the intended goal. We got to stop here, or maybe we'll pick it up there next week, Tony. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Don.
Thank you. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.